You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the United States experiments with undiplomatic diplomacy at the UN. My guests Florence Biedermann and Robert Fox will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the EU's brandishing of a yellow card at Poland, France's confounding of stereotype by making a grandiose yet meaningless gesture, and Rome's Christmas tree fails to go the distance. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. Right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, Defence Editor of the London Evening Standard, and Florence Biedermann, AFP's London Bureau Chief. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the United Nations, at which the United States has ditched the whole winning friends and influencing people tack in favour of, in the words of America's ambassador, taking names. Specifically, Nikki Haley intends, apparently, to ink onto some sort of ledger those who vote aye on a draft resolution criticising the United States' decision to recognise Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Ambassador Haley could probably save herself considerable elbow ache by merely printing out a list of every country in the world and crossing out the United States and Israel. Florence, first of all, what sort of talk is this, really? She says she's going to take names.
It's like you're at school, you know. Well, it's a Trump style, in a way. I mean, not caring too much about diplomacy, presenting the fact that you talk openly and directly is something positive, even if it's to propose that kind of incredible thing, because I think it's never heard of. So it may impress some countries. You say only United States and Israel. Maybe there will be some countries that will feel the threat can have a material impact on them and that won't vote. Let's wait and see. But in any case, I mean, it won't change the situation, as you say, like a majority of countries are not really favorable to this measure.
Robert, it is, of course, not unheard of for countries to bear grudges over diplomatic slights. And the UN is, of course, the preeminent forum for the expression of them. But the United States should be able to rise above this sort of thing, shouldn't it?
Yes, and I think the councils in Trumpland must be quite divided on this, because we know Mattis and Tillerson said don't do it, or at least don't do it now. I go a little bit further than Florence about this. I think this is a great big smokescreen, because it's looking a terrible mess. What did they get out of the Saudi Arabian crown prince over this? The bullying of the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mr. Abbas, the whole sorry story of Saad Hariri, what was really going on there. And I'm afraid that you're absolutely right. Park Israel, and yet again, Trump's attempts at diplomacy, not that he's attempted to, he's ended up as being nobby no mates. He's got no friends at all. And it is contempt for the history of this whole thing. And I think it's going to do damage to the United States, because I think it's yet another sign as to how they're marginalising themselves from what is going on in the Middle East. And we're seeing that over Syria too, because they can talk up various processes. And the thing that the United States has managed to do, along with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, they've managed to unite the entire political class of Lebanon, which takes a lot of doing. The initiatives are not coming from them. They're coming from Russia and the Astana peace process. This is another piece in that thing, and it's opening up tremendous dangers. One, just in particular, and won't go into great detail about it, is Gaza.
Well, indeed. But Florence, whatever one thinks about the idea of recognising Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and, you know, I can see that there is, when you remove it from the context, a certain logic to that, on the grounds that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. But you can't remove that from, of course, the context. And the US must have known what the reaction would be assuming they have completely haven't completely taken leave of their senses. They can't. The America cannot possibly be surprised, can it?
No, they're not. But everybody can see that the peace process is really since years and years. You hear this expression now, since maybe since Oslo, and the meaning is less and less. So what will it basically change on the ground? Not much. Symbolically, of course, it changes. But the reaction in the end was not that strong from the Palestinian side. Yeah, there is discontent and so on. But it was not the hell that some people were expecting. So let's see if the problem now is to see if Trump has a diplomacy and if Trump has his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has some proposals, some real proposal for peace.
Robert, do we yet understand what, if indeed there was the underlying strategy behind this from the United States point of view? If we take as read that they knew that this would be unpopular, that it would prompt at the very least a measure of unrest and disturbance and violence, and it did, perhaps not a great deal by the relative recent historical standards of the Middle East, but nonetheless people died, people were injured, property was destroyed. Do we have any sense yet of what the United States thought was a fair swap for that? What they're actually getting from this?
Well, it depends who you mean by the United States. But the interesting thing with the United States, as Trump sees it, there are three commodities that he particularly struggles with: diplomacy, tact, and strategy. By that I mean strategic thinking, because this is the most unstrategic mood you can conceive of.
Is that because all of those things involve being able to understand what other people might think?
Well, to go back to Florence's point, yes, I do agree that the Oslo process is all but moribund, but it is still there, and the five principles on which you were to move were terribly important, of which is Jerusalem is particularly important. Why you have this? Why you have the claim? I mean, even the UN in its very early years, when Israel became independent, even talked about Jerusalem becoming a completely international city. What is happening? What Trump has done, unfortunately, I think, has tipped it to the right, because one of the things that hasn't achieved the prominence that it might have done is an interview given by Naftali Bennett, who is in the cabinet, defense minister currently, and leader of the Homeland Party. And his proposal was, yes, the Palestinians can have autonomy on steroids, as he put it, but no independence. This is pushing the Palestinians back. And with it is a recognition that the United States seems to have an understanding, again with Saudi Arabia, which is so crucial, is that the settler movement and the settlers can stay where they are. There's no removal. And it's very interesting, the sinister thing of what Naftali Bennett was talking about, an enormously important figure, is, yes, you can have autonomy on steroids. I don't want to be too technical here, between in areas A and B. But Israel, what he is suggesting, because this is a security area close to Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and I think Hebron, crucial areas, they're talking about further annexation. What I am really fearful about is that we're going to a hornet's nest of a packet of trouble in 2018, there will be the push against Hezbollah, risk of war to the north. There will be unrest in the occupied territories. There has been a fair amount of activity, but I think that, again, the militants on the Palestinian side, unfortunately, are thinking out their strategy because they've started tunneling again and so on. And the problem of the imminent collapse, total collapse of life, ecology, everything in Gaza, I think could be the catalyst to really a very, very difficult situation indeed.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Poland, which has been directed to the doghouse by the European Union. The EU has invoked in Poland's direction Article 7 of the Lisbon Treaty, which unleashes a variety of disciplinary measures, possibly up to and including suspending Poland's voting rights at EU summits. This is in response to what Poland's government calls reforms of its justice sector and what the EU and anyone else capable of inferring conclusions from evidence calls flagrant political interference with a theoretically independent judiciary. Florence, first of all, the Polish government says that they're not actually obviously trying to suborn the independent judiciary to the whims of the government. The Polish government says that they're trying to root out inefficiency and corruption. Are we buying that?
The opposition, I mean, there are lots of polls who don't buy that, and the liberal opposition is, of course, criticizing this. It seems like the measure, which I cannot detail one by one, are really have really put the judiciary under the control of the government. So whether they call that like fighting against corruption or not, I mean, it seems that it, if the EU has waited like since nearly a year, they are telling them, be careful, don't
adopt this. This is not Poland's first warning.
This is not, and I think this is the accumulation that makes it now clear, I mean, in which direction it moves. So, of course, no, we don't buy that. And the EU doesn't, obviously.
Robert, the polls have been given 3 months to sort this out. I think it's probably a fair assumption that this is unlikely. What happens then?
There does seem to be growing confrontation with the EU, with a number of their eastern partners, not only Poland, but Mr. Orban in Hungary, and, of course, what we have seen in Austria. What I think is so worrying is that, you know, culturally and in political culture, Poland has always looked west, and particularly to France. And the idea that, you know, France that enounced with various political philosophers the division of powers so eloquently, which informed the American Revolution. I don't want to go into a history lesson, but it is a fundamental. And I think the EU is absolutely right. And they're desperate because then it's not going to be resolved in 3 months, because this seems to be all of a piece of the PIS, of the Law and Justice Party. And it really is saying that, you know, we don't like wayward judges, possibly corrupt judges, and they want to dismiss judges from the highest court, from the Supreme Court, and cutting down the powers of the Independent Constitutional Commission. This is very serious indeed. But o tempore o mores, you know, we are living in these times. What do the PIS say? Our opinion poll soundings say 81%. Of Poles, Polish voters support us, and this is going to be a head-on collision, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult to see where the path of compromise lies. In brief, you're absolutely right; it's not going to be resolved in 3 months, and I think with the concomitant troubles with Hungary and potentially with Austria, I think it's going to be a lot worse.
Florence, the Poland's government, rather amusingly, has described the EU's decision as political, which is fairly cheeky of them. But the EU is it's in a fairly hopeless bind here, isn't it? Because any pressure that the EU brings to bear upon Poland to try and sort itself out in this regard does kind of feed into the Law and Justice Party's narrative of, you know, defending the interests of the Polish people against the outside interferer.
Yeah, it's a bit like kind of attitude that Trump can have, saying he defends the little people. This is what's worrying also. It's like this
Brexiteers.
This cultural divide there is now between like Hungary and Poland on one side and the rest of Europe, like Western liberal Europe. And those two countries really see the West like kind of not an enemy, but there is an enmity. And this liberal system is even compared with the former communist system by some in Poland. So they are trying to pretend they are creating kind of a new world that is really defending the people compared with those old democracies that are run by elites who think they know what is good for the people when in fact they don't really represent them. And I think this is also a really worrying divide.
Well, just to follow that up, Florence, you mentioned Hungary, which has, you know, almost by accident ended up forming a sort of obdurate bloc with Poland. Hungary has already said that it will block any attempts by EU to properly come down hard on Poland. Now, if Poland knows that, does the EU actually have a meaningful threat it can make?
Well, it's still possible to threaten them with the money. Like, for example, the European fundings could be delayed, postponed, suppressed. But definitely, no, there won't be any unanimity to ban Poland from the right to take decision and to participate in the decision of the 27. This won't happen because of Hungary. But, I mean, money can be also an important leverage.
Robert, are we seeing yet another manifestation of a wider problem here, that the EU, it's basically, it was founded and it's always operated on the assumption that governments of EU countries would essentially be basically reasonable, liberal, pluralistic and law-abiding. Does the EU appear to have any framework for what to do when a constituent government? You also mentioned Austria, and it's obviously a bit early to see which way that's going to go, but I think 48 hours in, it's looking other than encouraging. Does the EU appear to have any real idea what to do when an EU country stops behaving like they would like an EU country to behave?
Or want a different dispensation? I think it's your famous acronym, Andrew, CLC, the Cozy Liberal Consensus, which is breaking down left and right. And Florence is absolutely right to allude to the Visegrad Four, who now seem to be forming a bit of a bloc. You know, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, the people who came in later and who really don't like the ways that the liberal ways that are being proposed by the Western countries. But don't think it's as simple as that, because look what's going on in Sweden now, where they're getting very tough, very draconian laws. And the driver, the big, big elephant in the room is migration and the speed of migration, which is worrying.
This has been another place where area in which Poland and Hungary have refused to cooperate.
That's exactly so. And as I said, even Sweden seems to be on with the very liberal noises which are coming out even from government circles there. Denmark likewise. And I think that this is the contradiction that we're seeing post Brexit. It's not being driven by Brexit. I'm not fixated, but Brexit is the occasion. Because while the oldsters, as it were, led by people like Juncker, say now is the time to converge, now is the time to come together, where we can have a unified economy and so on, the tendency is for social anthropologists is it to be centrifugal. It's the cracks are enormous. And I was muttering to you something just as we came to the studio. You watch Italy next year. Italy looks programmed to have if I could put it like this, a more than unusually chaotic general election in which it's going to be very difficult to get any consensus at all, even if you can in that country. And you're seeing divisions left and right. But I am serious about this north, south, east and west, particularly as the Mediterranean's become more difficult. So this is yet another swallow and there's a big summer coming behind it.
Well, that's something to look forward to. On that happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Florence Biedermann and Robert Fox, more shortly.
Who's up, who's down and who's out? As the world begins to hunker down for the holidays, we unwrap our annual soft power survey and much more in Monocle's bumper December-January double edition. In a tumultuous year for global politics, we play snakes and ladders with the world's soft power rankings, revealing whose worsening image abroad has seen them take a downward slide and which nations on the charm offensive are climbing to success. We also visit a tiny country with a rich history, San Marino, the world's oldest republic and a nation proud to defend its traditions, crossbow in hand. Next, we grab our first-class tickets, head to our favourite airline lounge and jet into Monocle's annual Travel Top 50. From revamped modernist hotels to the best new high-speed trains, we pack a year's worth of travel highlights into this comprehensive survey. Our voyage continues into the inner workings of National Geographic in our culture pages as we take a peek behind that famous yellow border to see how one of the world's most coveted print titles remain relevant in an ever-changing world. The best is saved until last for you this festive season as our inventory pages unveil Monocle's Christmas gift guide featuring 200 plus present suggestions. From wine and cheese to technology and tools, there's something in here for even the finickiest of friends and family. Monocle's December-January issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller, still with me are Florence Biedermann and Robert Fox. And let's look now at France, which has accrued a substantial acreage of headlines with its announcement that it intends to ban fossil fuel extraction on all of its territories by 2020. The vote was waved through in Parliament over the objection of right-wing parties and the abstention of left-wing ones. Critics have pointed out that France produces every year roughly the same amount of oil that Saudi Arabia does before lunch on any given day, and that this is therefore a gesture about as meaningful as a Mauritanian moratorium on puffin hunting. But Florence, is this a big deal? Is the symbolic gesture important?
Well, it depends for who. If you ask for the French people, I don't think it's changed much of their life. As you said, the production of fossil fuel, I mean, is 99% based on import. And the only area where it is extracted is Guyana, which is pretty far from the continent. So it won't change much. Yes, it's a symbol. So you can decide a symbol is a bit ridiculous and laugh about it, as you just did. Or you can decide still it's in a continuity of a policy that has started with the COP21, the Paris Agreement, the insistence of Macron and of France, and of other countries, by the way, that we try to fight against the climate warning. So it's an important issue, and yes, it's a very symbolic gesture, but it was not presented as something really big and a big success in France. And by the way, yes, there are some environment preoccupation in France, but it's more regarding the nuclear industry and the nuclear power, because this is the real source of energy in France. And at that level, Macron had made some pledges before he was elected, and it seems the rhythm of dismantling of this nuclear industry will be slower than what he said. But still, I mean, that he continues to try to put Trump back in the agreement, even if there is not much hope, that he kind of represents a leader who tries to make his best to do something for environment. Why not?
Just to follow that up, though, Florence, is what is represented by this ambition of ceasing fossil fuel extraction in France and all that it represents, is that a popular agenda with France generally? There's also talk of ending the sale of diesel and petrol cars by 2040, possibly, I think, more importantly, working harder to make France a world leader in renewable energies. Is that the kind of thing that any president, not just Macron, but anyone who succeeds him, would be able to bank on being popular?
No, I mean, I think if Macron will be popular, if that can be done, and at the same time, if he can improve the economy, then it will be seen as something really enhancing the status of the country internationally and also internally. But it's not the main focus of what the people expect from him. But still, there is a large part of the population which is sensitive to environment as in the rest of the world. But it's not the main electoral argument, I would say.
Now, Robert, is there something up for grabs here, the race to be a global leader in renewable energies? Because we are at the beginning, at least, of the end of the fossil fuel age, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And at the moment, as Florence was suggesting, it is really largely gestural, which is problematic. It's not going nearly fast enough, because environmental degradation is quite shocking when it sort of hits you on the end of the nose. I've just been in the deep south. I've been in the Falkland Islands and talking to ecological NGOs. There were one or two, very, very good ones indeed. And it was borne on me, for instance, the problem of plastics pollution. It's granular plastics. And there, it's a first-class laboratory for this, looking at gillfish, other fish that get these tiny granules in them. By the way, plastic is a byproduct of the oil industry. There are places in Europe, though, just to go on another tack, where I think it is more serious, more urgent. The Netherlands, after offshore oil and gas seemed to be on the decline, discovered a great gas bubble under North Holland and part of Groningen and Friesland. And exploiting that, rather in the manner of fracking, they've had minor earthquakes. It's caused colossal damage across a large area. I can hear the phones ringing, tweet going, but it really has. I mean, there are friends, neighbours that I know across quite a big area, and it may well have to be addressed. But I think that, again, I agree so much with Florence, with Macron as with Trump. It's almost irrelevant. It's what they can do for the economy. Can they get economic resurgence, then all will be forgiven. But if they both fail, then we will be looking at other things in another way. But the aspiration to binning the internal combustion engine and diesel by, say, halfway through the century, I think more and more as we go through the next decade, that really is going to become urgent.
Just a final thought on that ambition, and it is a very clear one, Florence, to remove diesel and petrol cars, or stop making them at least by 2040. Well, is that something you think French people will subscribe to? Because there is a you know, as you know, a huge automotive culture in France, as there is across the developed world, but also a native industry of great car manufacturing, of which the country is correctly proud.
Yeah, but I mean, diesel is when the prices go up, when you try to stop it, it affects the people that have less money, because this is the cheap energy. So of course it doesn't please the people, neither the taxi driver nor the people who have such cars. So again, it's again an economic problem. If their situation improves, if they don't feel like it's threatening their everyday life, they will agree in the end.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at a brouhaha in Rome concerning the city's Christmas tree, which has enraged local citizens by having the temerity to die and shed its needles all over the Piazza Venezia. The sort of people who get upset by this sort of thing have dubbed the hapless pine spallaccio, which translates more or less as mangy. It is being perceived in some quarters as a metaphor for the current governance of the Eternal City by its mayor, Virginia Raggi, and the somewhat threadbare policymaking of the five-star movement she represents. Robert, so that question really, is it the tree that's upset people, or do they perceive some wider resonance?
Si chiama uno spelacchio. It's a spelacchio, which is a bug brush. It's a loo brush. That's what. Let's get that clear.
I apologise for both my mispronouncement and my mistranslation.
Let's get that clear. It's a wonderful story. And it's a wonderful story. I bet spelacchismo. We'll go into the Italian political vocabulary now, because you're absolutely right. I mean, this was a disaster. This poor creature grew up and had a very tranquil life in the Dolomite Mountains. Then it gets loaded on a lorry. It gets incorrectly loaded, would you believe it? It isn't covered as it comes down and goes down the misnamed Autostrada del Sole. And it's shedding needles by the time it gets to Piazza Venezia, which is made famous by Mussolini on his soapbox, and that was the place that he spoke there. So, but it really is the heart of civic Rome, and you're quite right. It is being used as uno spelacchio to beat the Virginia Raggi and the disaster of her administration as mayor. She came in with high hopes just a year or so ago. But I do have sympathy for her, because actually the governance and the governing of Rome is absolutely a nightmare. It's riven with organized crime. It's dysfunctional. The infrastructure is pretty hopeless. But it is a harbinger, as I've said, of the election coming up, where the five-star movement is supposed to do very well. It's riding high in the national polls, with or without spelacchio.
What do you think, Florence? Is a prematurely dead Christmas tree the kind of thing you get away with as mayor if everything else is basically going all right?
I guess so. What I see also in it is a very Roman story. I will be less political, and there is always this idea that Rome is this decadent city. As Robert said, it never works. It's not possible that it works. So it goes back to La Dolce Vita. There is La Grande Bellezza, modern version of it, which is this city is very beautiful, but is slowly, slowly getting ruined. I mean, it's getting ruined since generation and century, so it's still okay. But this idea of decadence is so Roman. So to have that kind of scandal around the tree is a bit Roman too, I think.
You think they're kind of enjoying it at some level?
Yes.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like, I mean, if a Christmas tree died in central London, it would be broadly the same, wouldn't it? There's that sort of Brit. That's one of the things the British do have in common with the Italians, is they slightly enjoy things going wrong.
Particularly with people like Boris Johnson and Brexit. I mean, it's an absolutely free fire zone for we of the commentariat and the general. Absolutely right. It's a wonderful, wonderful talking point. But I am reminded so much, because I've worked a lot in Rome, of what Florence has just said, because very few people claim to be Romans. There are real Romans, but it's a place of lodgers and cardinals and dodgy crooks from the south and fridge and motor salesmen from the north. And it's a wonderful pasticcio. It's an absolute confusion.
And of course, the Brexit metaphor involving a Christmas tree would be somebody sitting on one of the branches and then soaring off the branch they were sitting on. That brings us to the end of today's show. Florence Biedermann and Robert Fox, thanks for joining us on Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Matt Alagaya. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.